Recording. Okay. You did very well in your homeworks. I have to learn how to ask more focused questions. Sometimes I give you a homework and say do something, and I don't ask you enough questions about it. But I was more or less okay this time. A lot of you found strange rapid rises with the branch and bound method when you plot it. That is how it behaves, but it's very data dependent. And so any generalization that you make, you know, I asked you for how fast it went up, or I really asked it on the heuristic search. The heuristic search, people had various exponents of n, usually around somewhere n between somewhere between 2 and 3, but it varied a lot, and that's data dependent. It's supposed to go up something like n cubed in the simplest case, but it also depends about how much, once you do some rearrangements, how many further rearrangements are triggered by that, and it's very hard to guess what that would be. I think in almost every case that people ran, when they did branch and bound, they got the same number of steps as in heuristic search. That's a favorable case for heuristic search, but many of you indicated that you weren't required to talk about this, but you indicated that you thought maybe on bigger cases heuristic search wouldn't do quite as well. A few of you got cases where branch and bound got better than heuristic search by a couple of steps. That is expected to happen. Branch and bound can be made to run faster, and it can be made to do larger numbers of species, but only for a little bit. Once you get up above about 20 species, it tends to bog down. Okay. I am going to assign another homework today. It isn't ready yet because I have to revise a lot the homework last time. It'll basically be using distance matrix methods. But what I think I'll do is change it so that it focuses on taking a data set with DNA and the same protein in the with amino acid sequences, and computing distances from both and seeing how the trees do. Because the example, the mammalian trees that are the mammalian data sets I'm giving you aren't really good examples for that, because all the action happens about 60 to 80 million years, 65 million years ago, a lot of it. But what you really would like to see is how useful are each of those kinds of data at different depths in the tree. And it would be nice if I can come up with some data sets that show you that. Okay, what I'm going to do is talk briefly about, and I will post it later today, but it's not up there yet. We talked about inconsistency of parsimony, and basically that comes from when you have a nearby but not immediately connected long branches. They tend to get moved together because the program doesn't understand, that parsimony doesn't understand that those are long branches, and that there can be cases where parallel changes are more probable than even a single change in a short branch. It doesn't weigh those correctly, and that's why you get inconsistency. There's one other case that I find it a little hard to get an intuitive feel for. I was saying in the literature that parsimony assumes a low rate of change in effect, and that it also assumes that differences in rate in different lineages. Well, Hendy and Penny, in 1989, came up with a case where there are no differences in rate in lineages. You have perfectly clock-like evolution. And you have this tree with five species, and these four, A, B, C, D, it's all very symmetrical. And you have a short branch in here, and the rest are long branches. What they found was that in such cases, if X was short enough, that you tended to get one of these lineages attracted over, and it would be one of the four pretty much at random because of the symmetry of everything, gets attracted over to become this, to be connected to E. And it's a little hard to understand why that is. What I will show you, and this is in the book also, is a simulation I did to verify this. Here is a tree. It has that structure, goes from left to right. I'm doing DNA. I'm evolving DNA with a simple symmetrical model of DNA change called the Jukes-Cantor model, which we will get to in within about the next week. And this is the length of the branch in terms of expected number of changes. And here's 0.30, here's 0.50. This here, if you're clock-like, is supposed to add, the branch is supposed to add up to 0.5. And what we have is a small branch of length B. Only the horizontal distances are branch lengths. And this one is 0.2 minus B, so that everything adds up. And then we try out different values of B. If B is 0.03, so that this is 0.17 and this is point, these two are 0.03 and then 0.30, and you simulate data sets, a big data set. You simulate data sets of different sizes on this. When there are 100 sites, you have out of 1,000 trees, you get the correct tree 100 times on that, in a sample of 1,000. And as you go up, when the number of sites get longer and longer sequences, it goes up satisfyingly, and it's headed up towards 100% when you get the right tree 100% of the time. But if you make it even a little bit smaller, just 0.02, so it's 0.18 and 0.02, still clock-like, it's very similar at 100 sites and then goes down as you get bigger and bigger sequences because there is this attraction going on. Basically, all four of those interior branches, long interior branches, are getting attracted to the outside branch, but fluctuations in the data will decide which one makes the fatal move. And here you can see it's getting worse. So there is an inconsistency phenomenon here in a case where there is a perfect clock, but it's a matter of having some short branches and some long branches still. Just not any difference in rates. So that's all I wanted to say about that phenomenon as another source of inconsistency. Where I want to go from this is to chapter 10, which is the chapter of the book I actually worked hardest on. And I actually did original research in the sense that I went back over the history of the field, and at certain points I had questions about, did you do this independently of that? And I asked some of the people involved, which I'm now very glad I did, because some of them are no longer with us. So I think it's probably the best quick summary of the history of what? Well, not of all of systematics, not of all of molecular evolution, but of the inference of phylogenies by numerical methods. People had been looking at phylogenies since Darwin, a little bit before Darwin, really, but since Darwin, and since Ernst Haeckel in 1866 or something coined the term phylogeny, but largely they've been done by verbal, intuitive methods. And there were various statements in the literature going back about how you got them, but they're very hazy. I'll be getting into this early hazy history, but where the history we're going to cover really starts is with the beginning of the use of numerical computing devices, because then you have to specify, if you're talking to a computer, you have to tell it very precisely what to do. Vagueness is not an option. Okay, I'm going to start back in the 1950s when the dominant voices about taxonomy were Ernst Mayr and George Gaylord Simpson. They both were major figures, as it says here, in the modern synthesis, in the introduction, basically, of genetics into evolutionary biology. They also had a position on how you should do classification. And I'm going to make a distinction here between the classification system, groups within groups within groups with names for different levels, and the phylogeny, because those aren't always the same. And in particular, they aren't always the same. In this field of, in this school of systematists called the called evolutionary systematics, they were dominant until the 1970s. Both of them were at that point still alive. Meyer lived on until 2005. So he lived up, he was 100 years old when he died. And their approach was not to make the classification system a perfect reflection of the phylogeny. They, in fact, tended to allow some groups in the classification system that were paraphyletic. I'll go over what that means in a moment. But because what they assumed, built into their whole scheme, was the assumption that, that there were big differences of evolutionary rates, and that you'd have an evolutionary tree, and that some lineages would enter a new adapted zone. Classic example being, you'd have reptiles, and you'd have something starts to fly, and you have the beginning of birds. And what the picture they painted, both Simpson and Meyer, was that a lineage that entered a new adaptive zone would change a lot, that this would, in their view, change a lot of characters, and it would justify designating them, for example, as a new group, even though they had ancestors within another group, and the ancestors might be more closely related to some members of that group than another. So, in such a scheme, here it is happening again, family A is what's called paraphyletic. That is, it does not consist of an ancestor and all of its descendants, because some of its descendants are over in family B. So, if you make a classification system that is perfectly concordant with the phylogeny, you wouldn't really do that. This is a mixture of considerations of clade, that is, who is closest on the tree in the sense of sharing common ancestors, and grade, which is moving to some new adaptive zone and some new level. This was standard, and followers of Meyer and Simpson were in all the major museums, biological museums in the world, particularly in the U.S., and they held all the major curatorships. But neither Meyer nor Simpson was very explicit about how you do this. Simpson once complained about a practice, which in fact was also their practice. He said that systematists were trained more like performing monkeys than by instruction, that they were trained by imitation rather than instruction. And the general idea in those days, and we're talking as recently as the 1960s, was that if you wanted to learn how to make classification systems and phylogenies, there was no set of rules, there were no models, there were no algorithms. You went and apprenticed yourself to the great professor in the museum. You stood at his elbow for 20 years, at the end of which time you'd know how to do it. The corollary of that was that if somebody asked you how to do it, you would hold forth with a series of statements that made no sense whatsoever, because you wouldn't ever have been asked to think algorithmically about it. So, for example, there's a book by Ernst Meyer. I believe it's his Principles of Systematic Zoology. I'm trying to remember which of his books. There's a book about how to do taxonomy. And in it, he has one chapter about phylogeny. So I went to read that chapter saying, what is he going to tell us? And the whole chapter is a series of statements about how complicated it is, how biological considerations are very complex. There is no general rule. It's really something you can't write down. And he just goes on for like, well, he goes through 10 pages of telling you that he can't tell you. And that's it. This is what they did. And so you had groups in the classification system like Reptilia. I grew up thinking, oh yeah, class Reptilia. If you look in the classification systems now, you won't find it there. It's gone. Because reptiles as a group are not monophyletic. The common ancestor of reptiles is also our ancestor and the ancestor of birds, the ancestor of mammals and the ancestor of birds. They would make groups like Pongidae, which were the apes, excluding humans, because humans were asserted to have gone through a change of adaptive zone and be put in what they called hominidae. There still is a hominidae, but now it's different. Okay, so that was their classification system. Here's a tree of horses drawn by George Gaylord Simpson in one of his books, and what he shows you are genera. I'm looking back. Myohippus, for example. There's the genus Myohippus. Well, the genus Myohippus is supposed to have descendants that are in other genera. So it wouldn't pass muster in the present day. Plus, this is not a very precise phylogeny. You look at these big fat lineages coming out of other big fat lineages, and it is rather hard to see. Well, there's sort of an indication that this one is more genealogically closer to that one than either is to this one. But look up here. It's really hard to get any branching order out of that. And the trees are very fat. People have argued that in their hands, the phylogeny was gradually dissolving. People are gradually losing their ability to talk coherently about it. Not that they've been very coherent to the preceding period. To give you an idea of this issue of paraphyly, here is what we think is the correct phylogeny for the living here it says the chordates, with the first split being the amphioxus and then the sea squirts, the tunicates. You may have heard it going that it went the other way. This is the latest as far as we know. The lamprey and hagfish, the cartilaginous fishes, sharks and rays, most bony fishes, the coelacanth, well now two species of coelacanths, three or four species of lungfish, and then the tetrapods, the amphibians, and here we have turtles, snakes and lizards, crocodilians and mammals and birds. So you'll see this is a common ancestor of what used to be called reptiles, but that's why we don't have it in the classification system. If you say, well, where are the vertebrates? There are the vertebrates. They are a monophyletic group. That is, they consist of an ancestor and all its descendants. Or another way that's a definition I think works better, they have their own common ancestor, which they don't share with anybody else under discussion. And so that's okay. That fits with current practice. But the groups they made included groups like osteichthyes, bony fishes, which included raphen fishes, coelacanth, and lungfish, all called fish, all called osteichthyes. That's a paraphyletic group because some of its descendants include these things over here. Reptiles, which I've been holding forth on, again, a paraphyletic group. So they were making groups that were not completely consistent with the phylogeny. There was a distinction in their thought between the phylogeny and the classification system. And there came to be a number of... They were the dominant classification method. But people started advocating alternatives. One of them was a guy named a German entomologist named Willy Hennig. There was also, I'll show you in a moment, a photo of him and of another, Walter Zimmermann, another German entomologist They both advocated a phylogenetic, what was called phylogenetic systematics, which is that every group should be monophyletic. You shouldn't make any group unless it is monophyletic. And that group has ended up more or less winning out in the arguments about classification, and hence the reptiles have vanished. But there was another very interesting group, which is Robert Sokol and Peter Sneath, who advocating making a classification by considerations of overall similarity without reference to evolution. Not that they didn't believe in evolution. They neither of them was a skeptic of evolution. But they wanted to use numerical clustering methods. And I want to tell you a little bit about them. Oh, okay. First, I'll give the context in which all this is happening. The inference of phylogenies is technologically driven. What was happening post-World War II, a number of interesting physicists had moved into molecular biology and more or less almost were the people that started molecular biology post-World War II. The first protein sequence, for example, is determined by Frederick Sanger in 1951. There were people from code-breaking operations and atomic bomb laboratories who built some of the first computers, although there is no such thing as the first computer. There's estimated to be 50 different machines that can claim that. So computers are rising, and so is molecular biology. In the late 1950s, you started to get enough sequences. These were protein sequences. Because nobody could do nucleotide sequences, that were where the same gene was sequenced in multiple species. That took a little while to happen. Most American universities got their first computer about 1957, usually a business machine bought from IBM. I was an undergraduate starting in 1960 and around the genetics department at the University of Wisconsin, where there was somebody, a guy, I know, a population geneticist who was there earlier than me, had been using their computers, and there's a set of manuals for the very first computer that the University of Wisconsin got. So although I never got to use that machine because it had been replaced, I have the manuals upstairs, and they're fun to read. So that's the atmosphere, is that computers are becoming available and molecular sequences are starting to become available. Consideration of molecular evolution was happening in the form of work by Emil Zuckerkandel, and in association with his co-author Linus Pauling, and of course Pauling, tremendously famous guy, who had the Nobel Prize in, I think it was chemistry, and then went on to win a Nobel Peace Prize. So he not only has two Nobel Prizes, but one of them was the Peace Prize. He was sort of the greatest chemist in the world. And he was interested in lots of things. So when Zuckerkandel came along and wanted to look at molecular sequences, he got involved. And they wrote three big review articles in the early 1960s, and one of the things they did, they looked at the sequences, they did a few little tabulations of things. They never thought about phylogeny methods, and they said, you know, you could infer ancestral sequences. They called this chemical paleogenetics. Really was another 30 years before anybody got back to that and really started doing things like inferring ancestral sequences and then trying to synthesize them and see how they worked. So molecular evolution is starting to get off the ground. Well, in the late 50s, these two guys, Robert Sokol and Peter Sneath. Sokol is here, Sneath is there. These are pictures. This is from the early 1960s. This one is from the around 1961, that's from around 1964. I faced the issue when I was doing the book of should I show pictures of them as they were now or pictures of them as they were then. I'm glad I did then because they're both dead now, so it wouldn't really work. What they did was to get involved in clustering algorithms for taking various kinds of data and discerning clusters, and in particular, hierarchical clustering, which you make clusters, and then you make clusters of clusters and clusters of those. That, of course, maps into a classification system. And what they took a very operationalist view, and they said, evolution has surely accounts for the diversity, but let's just go in with clustering algorithms, find out what are the natural clusters, and use those in the classification system. The history is a little interesting. Sokol has a very interesting background. He, as a teenager, he and his family, he was Jewish, his family fled Vienna, grew up in Vienna, they fled eastward, and they, when Hitler came to power with the Anschluss in 1938, when Austria was taken over by Germany, and the only place they could get a visa to was China, and they went to Shanghai, and so Sokol grew up, went to high school and college in Shanghai under Japanese occupation. He was then, his wife he met then, and she was Chinese, and Sokol was a fluent speaker of Shanghai Chinese. They came to the United States, and he got a PhD in systematics and evolution at the University of Chicago, working with the termite systematist Alfred Emerson. Sneath was a medical microbiologist working on bacteria at the University of Leicester in England. Both of them got involved in the late 50s in clustering algorithms in parallel without knowing of each other's work. Then they came to know of each other's work, and the smartest thing they did was not to say, I invented clustering. No, I invented clustering, and fight with each other. What they did, they looked at the outside world and said, we've got to convince everyone of this. So they allied themselves with each other and promoted it. And one of the things they did is that in 1963, Sokol wrote a book. Sokol and Sneath together wrote a book, Principles of Numerical Taxonomy. And this was the book that first got me into phylogenies. And it's actually a very, very well done book. It has nice, good figures, too. It was very influential. And one of the things it did was kick off the whole field of clustering. I mean, people had been inventing clustering algorithms for decades before, but usually in isolated ways, often individual fields of science, different fields of science. What they did is try to organize all of that. They invented some of the methods yet again, so a lot of reinvention was going on. And they then tried to say, here's categorization of methods, and here's how they behave. Let's look at how different methods behave. People working on mathematical clustering, whether or not they're in biology, regard this book as the sort of almost the founding book of mathematical clustering. So they had a big influence on all the people who were doing clustering. By the way, some of you know of these diagrams in genomics that you see where there are gene expression array boxes that are called heat maps, and along one side you'll see a clustering diagram. Usually there's clustering diagrams on two sides of them. Those are done using methods that came directly from numerical taxonomy. Some of them got reinvented since, but all of that machinery is in this book. Okay. Well, the other thing they're doing is advocating phonetic clustering as the basis for taxonomy. The Meyer-Simpson people hated that. It also was a threat to the Meyer-Simpson people because while their scheme was verbal and hand-wavy, this was precise and algorithmic, and it could be put on computers. And so basically, they scared the hell out of a generation of systematists and competed with them. Here is the first numerical phylogeny. Now, Sokol was not interested in inferring phylogenies, but he teamed up with Charles Michener, who was became the world's greatest bee systematist. He just died last year. They were both at the University of Kansas. And Michener had some phenotypic data on bees, and he wanted it clustered. And he wanted to interpret the resulting clustering diagram as a phylogeny. I always thought it was strange that Sokol was on this paper, because he didn't really, wasn't really interested in phylogenies. This was published in Evolution in 1958, I think, or 57, I believe. And these are bee genera of bees. But I happened to be at a meeting in the same room with both Michener and Sokol, and we were all leaving the room, and I sort of, there was a bottleneck at the door, and I was going through the door right next to them, and so I said hello to them, and then said, by the way, I have a question. Was it you, Robert Sokol, or you, was it you, Charles Michener, that wanted to interpret this thing as a phylogeny? And Michener said yes, and Sokol said yes, and Paul Ehrlich, who was in the chair and back in the room, who had been a graduate student at that time in their department, heard what we were saying, and he chorused out yes, too. So Michener wanted to take a clustering algorithm and make a phylogeny. This is the first numerically produced phylogeny. I have to be careful about saying it's produced by computer, because at the beginning of his work, Sokol was working with the data's on punch cards. And at the beginning, he didn't have a computer and was using punch card calculating machinery to do this, by passing the cards repeatedly through punch card machinery. Then soon after, computers became available. Now, that was what they were doing. At the same time, in the same era, in the early 60s, just about the time that numerical taxonomy is being published and people are noticing it, these two guys were working on gene frequency data in population genetics, particularly blood group data. They both had had association with R.A. Fisher, the great mathematical statistician and founder of theoretical population genetics. And one was Luca Cavalli-Sforza from Italy, who was an MD interested in human genetics. And he had gene frequency data from various blood groups, from various populations. He was, when he finished working with Fisher, where, by the way, in his work with Fisher, he actually worked on bacterial genetics, where he discovered one of the most important recombination systems, the HFR recombination system, which, if you look back at the citations on it, they're by some guy named Cavalli. Well, Cavalli, whose name later became Cavalli-Sforza, moved back to Italy after that, was at the University of Pavia, and was trying to do human population genetics, and became extremely eminent, as he still is. And the other was Anthony Edwards, who after exposure to Fisher, mostly as an undergraduate, trained in population genetics. And Luca said to Anthony, why don't you come to my institute? And so it was, in effect, a sort of postdoc. And they were looking at these gene frequencies in different human populations, so one species, but many populations. And they said, let's tie them, let's come up with a branching history of these populations. And one of the thoughts that they had was to consider each of the scales. So let me imagine I have three gene frequencies, one at each, an allele at each locus. And one of them is going horizontally across the room, and another is going, the frequency from 0 to 1 is going vertically, and the third is going back into the room. Each population will be at some point where my fist is in the room. And then they said, well, could you tie those together into a tree with a minimum amount of string, basically? And that's going to... that they could figure out ways to do. So here is a calculation from a 1965 Human Genetics Congress volume, but they invented the method a bit earlier. And it ties together human populations in a tree with the minimum amount of string. So it was a parsimony method in gene frequency space. So this is basically the first parsimony tree. Not discrete characters, but gene frequencies. By the way, if you look at the topology, it's not bad. It's generically similar to trees that have been made since by much larger data sets. It's actually... Now, what it doesn't take into account is that these are not species, and therefore, when the South Turks split from the English, there can be flow, gene flow between them. There's no biological species barrier to prevent gene flow. So the idea that their history is entirely branching, a branching history, is questionable within species. We'll touch on it later in the course. But for the moment, they're saying, well, at least we can get a sort of branching history out, even if maybe not represent all the gene flow. They also have... Oh, and one of the things they did was plot their tree on a map of the world. And it's similar to what people would do now. Now, they put the root about here. Now we would put the root down in Africa some way and have this represent the flow of humans out, of Homo sapiens out of Africa. They have a few weird things, like the Maori in New Zealand coming from British Columbia and Yukon. However, if you think about it, they don't have data there. If you take this, and they stretched branches in order to get the populations in place, if you take that node and move it back into Siberia, you're doing much better. This is not really evidence of a British Columbia, a New Zealand connection. Okay, so, but they came up with other methods. They also made a distance matrix method. They said, let's compute distances between the lists of gene frequencies in the populations, pairwise distances between every pair. How far apart are they? How far apart are those points in gene frequency space? And let's come up with a tree that does the best job of fitting that. I'll be telling you all about the methods that they and others invented once we finish this history material, history and philosophy material. Well, that's the second method they invented. So they invented the first parsimonia method. They were at least tied for the earliest distance matrix methods. And I believe it was Edwards who invented the parsimony one, and Cavalli-Sports invented the distance matrix one, and then they argued with each other which would be the better method. And they told me that they were going to a meeting in Naples, and Cavalli-Sports, of being wealthier, flew, and Anthony Edwards took the train. And both of them were thinking, well, how do we find out which is the better of these two rather arbitrary methods? And they both had the same idea. They both said, well, we could represent the movement of these points by genetic drift in the populations as if it were Brownian motion. We could approximate it by that. We're both influenced by students of R.A. Fisher, whose great principle was maximum likelihood. So they both said, let's figure out what maximum likelihood would recommend in terms of analyzing these data. Because surely it will select one of these two methods. So they got to the meeting in Naples, they ran into each other, they both said, oh, I've had this idea, and they'd had the same idea. And they said, okay, let's go figure out what likelihood would do, which they, when they got back to Pavia, they did that. And they found that likelihood, well, they had some difficulties doing it, but they found it wasn't either of those two methods. It was a third method. So now they had invented the first phylogeny method by parsimony, the first by distance matrix, and the first by maximum likelihood, all in the same project, which is utterly remarkable. Now, at the same time, Sokol was worrying about phylogenies because he wanted them to go away. He didn't want to deal with them. But he thought that one of the ways he could find out about them was to find out more about how you could reconstruct them. And show that it didn't work very well, that it was very noisy, and that clustering would be better. So he did this in order to disprove that you could do such a thing in an effective way. He had a collaboration with Joseph Kamen, an entomologist at the University of Kansas, and what they decided to do was evolve some organisms whose evolution they would know about exactly. Kamen invented organisms which came to be called the Kamenalcules, that were these rather cute, strange little beasts with heads and limbs or antennae and some sort of sucker attaching them to the substrate. And then Kamen made an evolutionary tree, carefully tracing, making changes in things like these spot patterns. And he evolved a whole group where they were traced from, these were apparently on Spirit Master, which were things you could run through a machine and crank out multiple copies with. And he filed all the ancestors were carefully filed in a filing cabinet, and the phylogeny was known. And then what they did is give these to students and tell them, reconstruct us a phylogeny by whatever methods you can think of. And Kamen reported that the students who did best made the reconstruction that required the fewest changes of state, which is basically parsimony. So Kamen and Sokol published a paper in 1965 without, I think, knowing about Edwards and Cavalli-Sforza's work, which had been published in 1964, in Evolution, explaining that how you would do this by parsimony and having computer programs to infer tree by parsimony. These are written in Fortran and available in giant decks of cards. I know because I got one of them. And so their paper was the first widely noticed parsimony paper, and it described things like rearranging the tree and sequential addition, which it did. So it was very influential in publicizing the possibility of parsimony. So Sokol, who wanted to show that parsimony didn't work very well, managed to establish it as a method. Okay. Well, there were further developments. Here are two people. James S. Farris, who was a student from the University of Michigan, trained, among others, with Arnold Kluge. And they were both originally at the University of Michigan. Farris then got a job at State University of New York at Stony Brook. He's currently retired and at the University of Gothenburg in Sweden. Kluge is still at University of Michigan. They published a series of papers in the late 60s, from 1969 to 1971 or two, of discussing further kinds of parsimony. Kamen and Sokol had the Kamen-Sokol parsimony, which I showed you, where you can only go in one direction. You can't go back. They basically, Farris invented came up with the first algorithms for how you count parsimony states when you can go in either direction. They've been largely superseded by the Fitch and Sankoff algorithms, but they did work fine. And he discussed rearrangements. He had a fairly clear view of the use of parsimony. They also advocated Willy Hennig's approach to classification, that you should make only monophyletic groups. Now, there's a whole history of fighting about classification. In the numerical taxonomy conferences of the 1970s, ending up with the group splitting, and Farris and allies who were interested in monophyletic classification and the use of parsimony founded what's called the Willy Hennig Society, in honor of Willy Hennig, who had died in 1976. They were very important in advocating monophyletic classification and the use of parsimony. Well, what about molecules? Here we come with a very interesting figure of Margaret Dayhoff. The late Margaret Dayhoff died in 1983, who was a biophysicist who there's a picture of her in about 1966, was at the National Biomedical Research Foundation, a private foundation, a private nonprofit foundation in Silver Spring, Maryland, near NIH. And she got interested in protein sequences. And in particular, she was very evolutionary and very numerical. And she started creating, she had the idea of saying, well, look, all these protein sequences are starting to get published here, there, and everywhere. We need to have them all collected in a single place where people can refer to them. And so she created the Atlas of Protein Sequence and Structure, which was the first database of protein sequences. At the same time, by the way, a man named Walter Goad at Los Alamos National Laboratory was trying to collect on computers the first all the DNA sequences that were published. He had people sitting there typing in from publications these DNA sequences. So Margaret Dayhoff published the Atlas of Protein Sequence and Structure. This is the 1967 edition. She started in 1965. I don't have the 65 or 66 one, but this is it. This is the database, all known protein sequences as of 1967. She invented the one-letter code that we use for amino acids, because she had to type them in a compact format. You couldn't just say ala, gli. You couldn't use the three-letter thing. She wanted it simpler, so she made up a one-letter code, which is the code in use to this day. So you'll look here and you'll see there's the sequences, there's some tabulations for tryptophan synthetase alpha in E. coli, for example, is this page here. Lactalbumin alpha in bovine is on the next page. Lysozyme in chicken. Is on the next page, and this is it. This is the entirety of the known protein sequences as of that time. It became what's known as the protein information, PIR, protein information resource, computer database later on, and then subsequently it's been merged in with GenBank. But the other interesting thing was that she was interested in organizing the genes by gene families. She was really a pioneer of the recognition of gene families. The people had already seen that hemoglobins were related. So she organized the whole thing she has consideration of what the gene families are. And she was very evolutionary, and she made evolutionary trees. And what did she do? Well, working with a guy named Richard Eck, they wrote a parsimony program. Kamen and Sokol's paper had been published. They made a parsimony program. Basically, you could go from any amino acid to any other amino acid in one step, which isn't very realistic. They didn't lay out their algorithm, so they missed the chance to pioneer the algorithms. Later on, she got more interested in distance matrix methods, and she tabulated empirical substitution rate matrices for amino acids about what's the frequency empirically in the data, taking the tree into account, that you go from alanine to glycine, for example. And so she has in here what's come to be called the PAM, empirically produced model of rates of change from one amino acid to another. And she pioneered, that was another thing that she pioneered. So she really is, she did the first phylogenies from molecular sequences, in this case protein sequences, in the 1966 volume of the Atlas of Protein Sequences. We're out of time. I'm going on to Walter Fitch, and then I'll be ending the history and going a little bit into philosophy. So we'll be doing that mostly next time, so we're falling a little behind the schedule. But I think this history stuff is important to understand, to get a feel for where all these methods, most of which you haven't learned about yet, came from. Thank you.